Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Hola, mi amigos. I'm back in the USA.
Hey, Christy, did you learn a little Spanish while you were away?
I spoke Spanish, or Spanglish, okay. I should really say. Yeah. But now I have to think, wait a minute, where am I and what language do I need to speak? Yeah. But here we are, and the Gravity Podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome back, compadres. It was, I will say, I held down the fort bravely in your stead last week.
Good work.
The interesting thing was the interview was one that I did by myself. And then I found that I also had to do the intro to the interview by myself. So it was a very,
you were alone.
It was a very different, there was a lot less banter. I just sort of got, I was like, hey, everybody.
Oh, so sad.
It's pretty much
so
sad.
For some listeners are like, thank God. It's just a really quick intro.
None I just want to hear from the guest. Yeah.
Banal rigmarole they put us through.
Yeah. Other people I have found, I don't know how to adjudicate this, but other people listen for the banter.
That's
so
there's, true.
You know, you can't please everybody. We're just going to do what we're just going to do what we do.
So. Yeah, we do what we do, but there is a fast forward button for those who don't like the banter.
That's true.
Which
is true.
If that's you, you're not listening to this. And but right, maybe you're under a great amount of mental strain. Because you have to put up with this. And if I'm the person to deliver you from that, from having to listen to my voice, just hit that fast forward button.
Yeah. You have permission. Some people, I think, do feel bad. Like they're like, oh, if I listen, like they would feel bad for fast forwarding through a podcast. But yeah, no
shame. Time it or fast forward. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Whatever you like.
Yeah. Christy, you were in a Spanish speaking country. Is that
I was in the Dominican Republic. Yeah. That's Dominican Republic. 15 high school kids, and it was so fun. They worked so hard. They had great attitudes. It was overall a really good trip.
Awesome.
But it was not a vacation. However, you were on vacation, Matt.
Yeah.
Not in the Bahamas. That's what Ben said last week.
I think I said the Bahamas last week, and I realized it midweek, and I was like, I don't think that's the country.
No. Yeah. I confuse Bahamas and Bermuda because I conflate them because they both start with B.
And
they were
island?
Together in that Beach Boys song. Wasn't it a Beach Boys song? Bermuda, Bahama.
Ooh, come on, pretty mama.
Come on, pretty mama.
That's what you sang to Sharon.
Yeah, that's what Sharon loved it, I bet.
My dad, for those who didn't hear, I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago, my dad took me and my siblings on a cruise. We went to Bermuda out of New York City. Our Lyft driver to the airport yesterday was from the Dominican Republic.
Oh, cool.
Anyway, it was really good. Really, really good. There's a whole lot of reasons I like Bermuda. Including the fact, did I mention this? That there was no population when the Europeans showed up. When they found the island, it's like the closest landmass is North Carolina and it's 680 miles away.
Wow.
And there was no human population. And so there isn't a long sort of imperial colonial legacy there of like slavery. There was never slavery on the island. There was never any sort of economic oppression on the island. And so it's basically like if London had a baby with the Bahamas. Ben.
Oh, okay.
If London had a baby with the Bahamas and it's like a very British/Caribbean culture without colonialism.
Okay. Little Bermuda. Baby Bermuda.
It's wonderful. Bermuda. Baby Bermuda. She's gorgeous.
Like a song as well.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we had a good time. But I'm back. I'm like right back. I got home last night at like 11 p.m.
Oh, gosh.
And now we're right back in it.
I got like 600 hit the emails. Ground running.
Yep. Ooh. Preach Sunday.
That's a lot.
I'm evening meeting tonight and tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, breathe, friend. Breathe.
Yeah. Welcome back.
But today, we're interviewing a friend of mine who I'm actually going to the book release party tonight.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
It's super incredible. Fun. Sam Joelman and is a friend of mine and wrote a really incredible book. It's definitely worth the read. on sexuality, the sex talk you never had. Hmm. There's like a tagline. I'm sorry. I really should know it because I'm doing this intro, but I don't know the tagline, but it's a really good one.
Great book. We definitely mentioned the name of the book in the interview. So yeah, stay tuned.
Yeah, we did.
We should insert the tagline with a AI generated voice.
Can it be me? Can it be my AI generated voice?
That'd be great.
All right, guys, I just used the internet and the book is called, just to do Sam justice here, the book is called The Sex Talk You Never Got, Reclaiming the Heart of Masculine Sexuality.
There you go.
There's the book.
There you go.
It releases today, Tuesday.
And if you're in the Colorado Springs area, come on over and celebrate. There's going to be a giant charcuterie board, which I am a big fan of. So,
Yeah.
Anyway.
I do like that.
I like charcuterie as well.
Yeah. So that's what today's interview is. And it's one of those books I really feel like you should read and talk to somebody about it. Like have dialogue about it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I never got a sex talk. Man, it really hasn't negatively impacted me at all. So, no, I really wish. I mean, now I have a 15-year-old, and you know, I have these sporadic little conversations that are sort of continuing. But it's actually nice to have someone kind of through a book sit you down and be like, kind of reparent you. You know, here's what you need to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's such a we talk a little bit about this in the interview, but it is such a complicated thing because I think some people who did get a sex talk got it through that lens, you know, of just such a harsh, shame-filled purity culture kind of lens that it's like, ugh, like sex talk. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? So there's just so much wrapped up in it. And then I found the conversation with Sam to be really helpful. I think his perspective as a therapist really, really helps to bring some good healing, you know, to a lot of folks who've got some jacked up ideas. And you know, if you live in the modern world, you do have some jacked up ideas. We all do because of, you know, just media and everything else that we've.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Have to endure.
All right.
All right. So is that it, friends? Should we get into it?
If you're fast forwarding, now is the time to stop fast forwarding. You still hear my voice. It sounds like the intro, but I'm just telling you again, please stop fast forwarding.
Yeah.
We're about ready to get to Sam.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
You're going to miss the beginning of it. I guess they can rewind as well though. So that's the blessing. So, all right, friends, here we go. Let's get into it.
Sam Juhlman is a professional therapist with over 20 years of experience specializing in men's issues and sexual trauma recovery. He seeks to help men and women heal, know their stories, and find greater sexual wholeness and aliveness. He received his master's in counseling from Reformed Theological Seminary and has had future training at the Narrative Trauma Care through the Allender Center in Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. He lives in Colorado Springs with his wife, my very good friend, and three sons. Together, they enjoy exploring the best camping spots with their pop-up camper. Sam goes to therapy, loves fly fishing, and can often be found catching his breath on the floor of the local CrossFit gym. Today, he's here with us to talk about his new book, The Sex Talk You Never Got, Reclaiming the Heart of Masculine Sexuality. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
It's so fun when my people get to, like, you know, the listeners get to meet my people because Sam's one of my people. His wife is one of my dearest, dearest friends. And this book is phenomenal. I'm like super excited to talk about it. I'm just going to tell our listeners, part of the reason this book is phenomenal is not just is it well written and well thought through and has really good stuff, but it's also because of the character behind the book, and that's you, Sam. So I'm just thankful for you. Maybe to start out, like, tell us, like, what led you to write this book?
Yeah, well, ultimately, what led me to write the book is I have three sons, And I was thinking about, oh my goodness, what am I gonna convey to my sons about sexuality? My sons are, one of them is just turning 13 this summer. So, this was when they were younger when I started kind of thinking about the book, but the sense of like, what's the vision here for male sexuality? What's a good vision for male sexuality that, obviously kind of coming out of the Me Too movement, there was also some inspiration for like, right? Everybody was sitting in the horror of like, wow, this is way pervasive. Mm-hmm. The impact of male sexuality on people's lives. And, obviously I have a window into that just from sitting in a counseling office with people. But, I think kind of the whole world was asking like, is male sexuality just broken? Is there a redemptive way to embody this? At least that was my question as a man. And obviously out of my own life journey as a man, like trying to embody well sexuality and, knowing like, okay, God called this good in Eden, right? We have that. And what's the good here? Like what's the vision other than, and then obviously coming as well, I grew up in the church. And so coming, I probably had purity culture medium. It wasn't purity culture heavy, but enough of it to, have the embodied experience of like, don't lust is kind of the vision, right? Stay pure. Mm-hmm. And realizing even that fell short of like, that's it. That's just stay pure. Those kind of forces converge together. And I was spurned on primarily by the Me Too movement. I think that's what finally made me feel like something's got to be said here. Like,
You write this book basically kind of explaining that there's two ways to embody sexuality. And my guess is like the whole YouTube movement kind of opened up so many people's eyes to men aren't just animals. I mean, I think that a lot of times that's how they're portrayed as just like being a savage and that type of thing. And you kind of give this other piece of like, they can also be a lover. And maybe could you just double click on that, explain a little bit more about these two different ways that we kind of embody sexuality?
Well, so again, I call it being the savage. And it's an attempt at using sort of mythic language for this image of the monster, right? Like, and I've had men sit with me in counseling and even say that of themselves, right? Like, I feel like, maybe they're caught in some sort of sexual struggle or an affair or something. And they've said, man, I feel like I'm just fundamentally broken or I'm a monster, right? Like, and I think that's even somewhat the understandable image of male sexuality coming out of the Me Too movement, where I think the statistics are 90% of sexual abuse is perpetrated by men. That is staggering to me, 90%+. And sexual violence, sexual abuse. So, there's this sense of like, man, it can be very savage in the world. There's no question about that. But is it fundamentally savage? And I was wrestling with, this sense of like, what are the most, if you look at the Bible and ask the question, what are the pictures of the most virile men in the Bible, right? In a good way. Obviously you can find the savage in the Bible. Certainly that's there. But like, what does the Bible seem to set up as this good picture of virile, sexually alive men? And I thought of Adam naked in the garden, meeting Eve, and Song of Songs, right? As these two pictures. And obviously you might argue with me of like, are those the pictures, right? But those were two that jumped out to me, right? And the picture is of these two men that are you know, clearly in Song of Songs, this is a man who is sexually aroused. You know, there's mention of an ivory tusk in the description of his body, right? We don't have to use too much imagination there, but there's a sense of this is a sexually virile man. Adam meeting Eve, right? They're naked and without shame. And again, I don't know what went on in Adam's interior, but to mark again, some sense that there was probably arousal, at least a general body arousal in meeting Eve. But what do they do? Where does their virility, their arousal lead them? Right? The very first thing it leads them to is to write poetry. Mm-hmm. Right? They break out in poetry. It's not just right to a kind of violating or kind of grasping sexuality. They're certainly a pining after their beloved. But it first leads them to poetry. Mm-hmm. So something of saying like, whoa, that's fascinating. Now, I'm not necessarily saying every man needs to become a poet, you know, every time he's aroused to write a poem or something. But nevertheless, it's fascinating to me that what is that? Why are these men breaking into poetry around their sexuality? And that brought me to the image of the lover, that, you know, every man at his heart, maybe you could say his core sexual identity is as a lover. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm inviting, at least as the picture. And I, you know, I have this opportunity as a therapist to get this confidential conversation with a lot of men. And it's amazing to me how many men will confess behind a closed door. You know, guys will say something like, I feel more like the woman in the relationship because I actually want the emotional stuff. I actually need foreplay. I actually want to connect. I know, you know, this was literally in the last couple of weeks, a guy said, you know, I know I'm supposed to just always be ready and always just, you know, sort of get it up and be ready to go. He said, but I actually need that foreplay. Like, I want that. That's the good stuff to me.
We'll be right back.
Ben, you know what I love?
What?
My wife. My wife. But I also love theology and beer, and that's why we're excited to talk about Theology Beer Camp 2024.
Yes. Yes, it is a conference. It's a gathering in Denver, Colorado, October 17th through 19th that we got invited to participate in as a podcast. There's a whole bunch of podcasts that are going to be there. It's put on by Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity. And it's going to be a great gathering, Matt.
Yeah.
We're going to hear from Ilya Delio. We're going to hear from Brian McLaren.
Tom Ord.
Butler Bass.
Yep.
Tom Ord. Brian Zond. Lots of other folks. So yeah. We're excited to gather with you all.
We wanted to find some time to get together, and we're really happy to be invited into this. And we can invite you to join us here because I know many of you listen to our podcast, but you listen to lots of others as well. And there's, I don't know, 30 or 40 podcasts are going to be there. Probably many that you already listen to, some you don't, but you'll be introduced to. So if you go to gravitycommons.com/theologycamp and enter the code GravityHobbit, you get $25 off. What a bargain.
Incredible bargain. I hope to see you there. Again, it's October 17 through 19 in Denver, Colorado. gravitycommons.com/theologycamp and use the code GravityHobbit to get $25 off tickets.
Yep, join us. This month's online learning community is on reconstructing the gospel of Jesus. We're talking about how his gospel of participation, how he participates in our humanity, and then we get to participate in the divinity of Christ and God and the Godhead himself. This is an ongoing series that we've done every fourth Wednesday. This month, it's on June 26th. If you go to the URL gravitycommons.com/reconstructing, You can sign up for a premium membership of our Commons community and get access to all the past classes we've done, all the past learning communities, or you can buy this just as a one-off, pay what you can, pay what you want to come and join us. Even if you can't join live, you'll get a recording. This class has been incredible. We've been reconstructing what is the gospel that Jesus proclaimed. And this is the penultimate, that's one of Ben's favorite words. This is the yes. penultimate learning well community. So join us for this. I'm very excited. Ben and I will be in Louisville for this learning community. So we may even be on the same screen hanging out.
Who knows? Yeah. Yeah. You'll know that we're both real people at that point. So not AI. This sense of your imagination.
This learning community is actually coming out of what we've heard listener feedback about how the Gravity Commons podcast has been so encouraging and people want more theology, more Bible stuff, and to dive deeper in reconstructing a livable faith. So this learning community is all about reconstructing a faith that is worth believing, worth living in 21st century. So join us Wednesday night, June 26th, 8 p.m. Eastern, for this learning community.
Yep. Again, you can go to gravitycommons.com/reconstructing to find the two different ways that you can register there. And yeah, this is like a big Zoom call, essentially. There's some teaching, but then there's a lot of time for Q&A for people to post things either in the chat or to unmute themselves. And so it's a really fun way to see faces and have some community around learning. That's why we call it a learning community.
Yeah. So let's learn together. Let's get back to the show. Sam, I wonder maybe if I can just explore this idea with you of like the monster that is our sexual desire. Because I think that what I'm in touch with is essentially these two poles of, like you said, like the goal is to be pure, whatever that means. Basically, don't act on sexual desire. Usually, it's like don't right. do something. Purity is a lack of sin. Or I'm just afraid of this monster that lives under my bed that's going to, you know. And so there is like this terror that men have of their sexual desire.
Right.
And then if the sexual desire gets expressed or finds release in some way that's undesirable, then there's just shame and guilt.
Right.
Can you talk a bit about how we deal with this fear, like the fear of being ourselves, the fear of having sexual desire? How do we begin to face that and even move through it?
Yeah. Well, I think you're saying well, right? This idea that purity, if your goal is purity, it sets up this sense of don't have something, right? Stay pure. Don't be tainted, right? And it's actually language that my clients will sometimes use to describe their shame. Like I feel tainted or stained or spoiled in some way, right? I feel dirty. It sets up this tension of like you're saying, wow, there's this fear of what moves in your body. And that everything that moves, right, needs to be held with some suspicion. So if you are around somebody you find attractive, that you probably need to shut down whatever's happening in you and be afraid, because again, you know, this sense of, well, it's every man's battle, so get ready, here's yours, it's coming, right? And I think it really creates this animosity with our own bodies. You know, as I say in the book, we end up repenting of having a body in the means to killing the flesh. On the way to the killing the flesh, we end up repenting of our own body itself and what moves in us. So I'm inviting in the book, just staying longer with what moves in you. And again, back to those pictures of like the lover in Song of Songs or Adam in the garden meeting Eve, naked and unashamed, right? There's something that moved in these men towards good, right? Poetry being this image of goodness. And so letting, you know, trusting like you don't have to, it's not an instant, like you're in the ditch of lust. Those aren't the same. You know, arousal is not the same as lust. Arousal can become lust, but more for what happens in your heart.
So can I ask a question about that? So you're delineating between things that I think often get conflated and confused, right? That that arousal or attraction, maybe we could say attraction, is for many Christians, I don't think there's a great understanding or awareness about how that is something different than lust.
Yes.
And you use this phrase of staying with.
Yes.
Could you describe, let's say that I have no idea how to do that. Or maybe we could just say Ben has no idea how to do that. Ben has no idea how to do that.
In a hypothetical world, some people might struggle with.
How do I delineate between attraction, arousal, and lust? And then how do I stay with attraction if I wanted to?
Yeah. So, you know, if you're a fan of the Bible Project and them walking through, right now they're walking through the Sermon on the Mount. And is it okay for me to bring this up? Another podcast?
Sure. Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
so
of course.
They walk through the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, you know, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery. But I say, if a man looks at a woman lustfully, he's already committed adultery in his heart. And they said well in the podcast, this idea of a man who goes on looking is kind of how they translated that passage, for the sake of his own sexual gratification. So this idea, again, they're holding something's happening in the heart, not just in the body. So literally in the science of sexuality, I guess you could say, this is coming from a woman, Emily Nagoski. She wrote a book, Come As You Are, but she describes arousal, this idea of arousal non-concordance, which is true of men and women. It's even higher or lower concordance in women than in men. But this idea that arousal, what's happening in your body, is not the same as desire, what's happening in your heart. So you can have arousal and not have desire. You can have desire and not have arousal. And that I know this particularly through the category of sexual abuse, that your body can feel things that your heart doesn't want. Meaning they cannot be concordant, not agreeing, right? So, and Emily Nagoski describes sexuality. Arousal, she says, is more like sexual radar. It's just telling you something sexually relevant is happening. So you can feel arousal. Again, and this, you know, the horror of even what I'm about to say, that somebody could feel the pleasure of touch in sexual abuse. Meaning like if you just, you know, touch your own arm or somebody touches your arm, you will feel the release of oxytocin and dopamine. You will feel some pleasure just by being touched, right? And this is often the thing that damns sexual abuse victims is, well, you know, and even get scripted by their abuser, you wanted it.
Right.
Right. And that can feel confusing because there can be a sense of, well, there's something that felt good, right? Either the relational connection or, you know, something of the actual physical touch, but I didn't want it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it can feel to abuse victims that my body betrayed me. Right? Because why would my body feel pleasure from such a horrible person or from such a horrible experience? And that can feel very damning. But what's happening there is arousal non-concordance. Your body can feel things that is not congruent with your heart and what you want. So that's a long way to say staying with is just trying to not you know, literally regulating your nervous system as you're feeling whatever's moving in you move in you. And understanding that you have a choice. You could go to lust or you could go to something else. And the something else I say in the book is this category of awe, that you could actually be moved by the person and who they are and experience some reverence for them. Like I have a friend who was describing to me, he was watching Caitlin Clark in the NCAA Women's March Madness. And he was describing this pleasure he felt in watching her as an athlete, right? And her finesse and her like incredible skill as a basketball player. And he said, it's not lust. But then he was stuck, right? Like, why do I feel so drawn to watch her? And almost questioning, like, is it lust? He said, it doesn't feel sexual, but what is it, right? What's this other thing, right, that you could do other than look away or lust, right? And I said, I think you're feeling awe for her. She's an incredible player. She's very skilled and she has a finesse to her shots and how she plays. So this idea that you could actually be moved by a person, and moved with a kind of awe that could actually lead you to worship God, even to say, wow, that's amazing. And even further, you know, God, you make beautiful people. And obviously beauty in a fuller sense than just, you know, physical appearance, right? But the beauty of a whole person and what they bring to the world.
Yeah. Yeah. You could write a poem about them.
Yes. Well said.
Yeah. I love the distinction you're making, and that I just want to reiterate it because it's been so helpful for me. And a lot of what you're saying, resonates with some of, what I've read from the desert fathers who really thought about temptation and how it works, how it actually works in our bodies and in our minds and our hearts and all that kind of thing. And they do like delineate steps that like, and there's like two or three of them that can happen without sin, like steps of temptation that, you know, and then, you know, their ancient mindset, you know, they talk about it as like the devil, you know, kind of inserting thoughts and, you know, that kind of thing. And even like the entertaining of a thought, even the initial thinking of a thought is like, they went to great pains to say, it's not sin to have the thought. That's what being tempted is. You know, it's not sin to have the thought. It's just temptation. Jesus had those. Like he was tempted, you know? And that's just been really freeing, I think, for me and for a lot of other people who have, as you were saying, Matt, conflated temptation with sin, like lust. And it's been really damaging because you're defeated before the battle even begins, you know? Like to actually... and I really like what you're saying, that you can move into awe.
Yeah.
You know, you can move into a kind of almost, I mean, you don't want to worship the creation, but there is a worship of God that I think can issue forth from the being in awe of something God created.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Like I think of, you know, scenes where Jesus experienced, you know, very sensual moments. Like the woman who comes and, you know, bathes his feet with her tears and wipes. And what is it? Pure nard, I think it is, that, you know, pours out the jar of pure nard and bathes his feet. Like you think about that. That's a very sensual. And I want to emphasize, I'm not saying sexual necessarily, but sensual. His feet are being kissed. He's experienced something of this woman's offering. And his response is, she's done a beautiful thing for me. Right? He's honoring the beauty of what she's kind of ritualizing there with him. Yeah. And I think, you know, some might say, well, that's because Jesus was, you know, that was a good scene because Jesus was not sexual. But I would say I'm convinced Jesus knew exactly where the line was, where this would cross into sexualizing of her, right? Where it would have crossed into lust. He's letting something of her touch and the beauty of the moment be a gift to him. He's taking in the fullness of what she's doing. And along with what you're saying, you know, lust, in my experience of walking with men, lust, you know, the guys that I walk with who are the most sort of caught in lust or tend to see body parts, right? There's a kind of mutilating quality. They aren't taking in a whole person, right? They're seeing parts that are arousing to them. It becomes very almost, again, my word is mutilating, but it's not humanizing. It's not taking in a whole person, whereas awe steps back and is, you know, that staying with that you talked about, Matt, is that like, I'm going to let the whole of you wash over me.
And now a word from a sponsor.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
I'm noticing, Sam, a lot of what you're naming for us and inviting us into has to do with embodiment. It has to do with being in your body, being aware of your body, being in touch with your body.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could describe, I think one of the major realizations for me in the last decade or so is how disembodied I live. Mm. And I wonder if you could describe, what does it mean to be embodied? And how do we begin to be at home in our bodies if maybe we aren't?
Yeah, that's good. So, you know, often, you know, again, sitting in counseling, I'll often ask a man, like, what are you feeling in your body right now? You know, because emotions are really just embodied states, right? We have sensation in our body that gets codified to us as emotion. So anger feels a certain way in your body, and that's how you know you're angry. Or sadness feels a certain way in your body, and we give it a name, an emotion name. Right, but those are body states. They start as a body state. And you know, I'll often ask a man, like, what are you feeling in your body? And most of the time at first, they're like, what? What did you just ask? Like,
yeah.
And they'll say something like, I don't know, or I'm fine. Like, why would you ask that, right? And there's a sense of, you know, I know that men in particular are held less as babies and children. And so there's this less, men receive less touch. So this orientation to the body through affection, right? That's one way we come to know our body. And also I would say in general, men are not invited to stay in their bodies, meaning to stay in touch with is what we mean by that, right? To stay in tune to your body, because we
like grounded in your body, right? Is that a metaphor for that?
Right. That's well said. Right. And you know, you're invited at work to push through, you know, work harder, tune out your tiredness, keep going, and take, you know, caffeine, alcohol, whatever it takes to keep going. My dad is a contractor in construction, and I grew up, you know, working with him, and for a couple of years after college worked for him. And I mean, there are men, I mean, salt of the earth men, right, that work for him, but there are guys that would go home and put down a case of beer and wake up the next day and push. And these are guys who are working 60, 70 hours a week. Right. And you realize to do that, they're having to have something to numb out the body. So I don't think that's just particular to men, but maybe it skews that way, right? That men are invited to push through, you know, athletically push through your pain, stay in the court.
I do think there's a cultural narrative or pressure or expectation that a quote real man isn't really in touch with what the body wants or needs, but is able to rise above the body to accomplish, achieve, conquer, etc. Right?
Yeah, so that's well said.
Sometimes stereotypically, right? And maybe this is a caricature even, but sometimes stereotypically that comes out in real men don't cry.
Well said. Yeah. Right. Right, right. So it gets scripted, right? And there's even a kind of hazing among men, right? Like, what? You need a break, right? Like, you're tired, right? And this kind of hazing or mocking of that. Well said. And along with emotion then, right? That there's this the unflappable man is the real man,
yeah.
Right? That though you're made of flesh, you need to act like you're made of titanium. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's especially that which we feel in our bodies that makes us vulnerable, right? It's like the only feelings that are allowed, again, in this script for men is like you can be angry,
yeah.
But that's an emotion that doesn't feel as vulnerable as sadness, right? It doesn't feel as vulnerable as tears or even just needing to take a break. That's vulnerable, right?
Right.
And the story just popped into my head. This happened years ago, but I think there was a player on like the NFL team, the Vikings, Minnesota Vikings, that didn't he die? Somebody died because they just didn't have any water breaks. There was like a practice they had where it was like, this is going to toughen you guys up to not get a water break. And a player literally died because they didn't have enough water, you know, like, so.
Right.
Anyway, it feels to me like the theme is vulnerability here. That's what we're not supposed to feel.
Right. And I think I remember, didn't Andrew Luck, the quarterback, didn't he get booed out of his own stadium? Because I think he quit for his body. He was like pretty beat up, and he's like, I don't want to lose the rest of my this quality of life. It. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he got booed on his last game by his own fans.
That happened right here in Indianapolis. Yeah, we're very, very aware of that whole thing. And yeah, I think that's another example of it. It's just Andrew Luck's body exists for our entertainment. Right. How dare he take care of himself?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Right.
This is why I wanted you to come on the podcast, because I feel like men need to hear this, but women also need to hear this, that men need to notice and be able to name what's going on in their bodies. And as women, we need to be able to give them the space and the encouragement and to allow them to actually do that kind of work. I think it's really important.
Yeah.
I wonder, maybe just as like a final kind of question, some of our listeners are having the sex talk with their kids. Yes. Right. And honestly, I'm one of those people who just, I believe the sex talk happens and it's one long conversation for the rest of their life, right?
Amen. Like, right.
The way that I'm talking to you know, my youngest is not the way that I'm talking to my oldest about sex, but it continues to happen, right? It's mm-hmm. an ongoing thing. And so I just wonder, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, how do we do this in a way that isn't creepy or awkward or unhelpful? What tips do you have? Kind of as yeah. we try to help create like a better vision, a better understanding of sexuality.
Yeah. Well, I'll plug this there. I actually wrote like a little ebook that you can get as a pre-order bonus. So if you buy the book in advance, there's a little ebook called How to Give a Sex Talk. And I talk Yay. About, in that it's short and it doesn't cover everything. You will be left surely with questions, but I try to at least give you a vision for something. You know, the sex talk, like you're saying, it's not one talk. And that's actually some of what men suffer is they got one very awkward, uncomfortable 2-minute talk and it was over, right? And mm-hmm. that leaves something unnurtured, as I say in the book, in a man. I think it's supposed to be, and I'm borrowing this from I can't remember her name right now, but a sex educator, she describes, you know, it's, you got to think of it more as like 100 1-minute talks. They don't have to be, you know, hours of conversation because, you know, no kid would probably be able to endure that anyway. Right. Like, whoa, time out, dad. Like, I'm good. Right? You never mind. Right.
Well, just the other day I was talking to one of my kids and he said something like, "Mom, what's a threesome?" He had heard somebody talk about it. Mm-hmm. So I told him and then he was like, "Okay, you want to play a card game?" Like it was,
yeah,
it was just like part of life. You yes, know, it wasn't like this, let's have a sit down and like look me in the eye and this awkward thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just life.
Right. So I think that's the best way to do it is kind of slake their curiosity thirst and then let them move on. Yeah. And that will build this cadence of, I can bring my questions to you. Yeah. I think there's an important aspect of also kind of predicting where their friend group is or where they are in terms of like, can you kind of see the path of their curiosity mm-hmm. and maybe speaking, preempting some of that. So, you know, we just had the actual official what is sex talk with our 7-year-old because the questions were going in that direction. And it was like, let's break it to him. So Amanda and I, my wife, you know, we did make that part a little more ceremonial. Like we read this little book and it was, you know, but it was still only like 15 minutes, I think. Sure. And he was good. Like didn't really have questions after that. But I think, you know, the sex talk starts when kids are born. You're obviously not talking necessarily about sex, but this idea again of embodiment. Mm-hmm. I think teaching children their bodies are good and honoring their curiosity about their own bodies and playing well with them, like, you know, learning to play well and help them be embodied to the degree they can. Affection is huge. Mm-hmm. So letting them feel the pleasure of good affection and affection they can be a part of controlling. They can ask for it when they need it. They can get off your lap when they don't want it anymore. Just learning how to be with their own desire as children, that's really important. Honoring curiosity is probably more for middle, you know, childhood, older childhood. It's when the questions start to kick in. And then I think, you know, in the teenage years and on, once they're awakened sexually, mm-hmm. right? I think it is so important to see it as dialogue. You know, purity culture really set up this kind of ownership of your children's sexuality, right? Like, you're the authority, or, you know, your dad kind of owns your purity, right? Or even your dad, as this, I've heard bad stories of, you know, dads who really force a kind of accountability conversation on their sons. And I don't think that's good. You know, at some level you have to honor it's their sexuality that you're helping them learn how to be with. It doesn't mean you don't have rules about devices or dating, but that there's dialogue. Here's why we're doing those things. And they get to ask questions like, you know, mom, what's a threesome? Or, you know, I had a friend that whose daughter got in the carpool line in the car and said, dad, what is, and drop the F bomb. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Right. And so there was a 1 minute conversation.
Right. Right. Oh, so good. Well, I want to encourage listeners to get this book and to read it and to get that ebook for free. And before you get off, tell us how our listeners can find you. What are your plug your pluggables, so to speak?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. The best place is my website, samjolman.com. That's where you can get the pre-order bonuses. I have a Substack. Love you to follow that. I write on ongoing conversations on men and sexuality there. Those would be the best places.
Awesome. Sam, thank you so much for being with us and for your work in this book. Really, really grateful for it.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Feels like we're just scraping the surface there. So much to dive into when it comes to sex, sexuality, gender, and reckoning with our bodies as places of sexuality. I mean, it feels almost like the medium of podcasting can't handle how intimate and vulnerable and sometimes triggering those conversations can be. Does anybody else feel that?
Yeah.
I as we were talking, I just recognized like this feeling of, just depending on who's listening, so trying to guess who's listening. You know what I mean? Like if we were having this conversation in a room, I think with people that I knew, I feel like we could go in the direction that it would be helpful, or, you know, maybe say some things that might be helpful for people to get triggered by certain topics. You know what I mean? All of that kind of stuff is just so complicated in a public environment when you don't really know kind of who's listening specifically.
It kind of makes me wish or want for like people who read this book to read it and discuss it. I'm not sure. I mean, sure, I'm sure reading it is great, but like actually processing it and having somebody that you could be honest and real with to really navigate the material and like talk openly and vulnerably, I think would be a great second step to reading this book. That would really cause, I think, life change, like formation really in us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that reminds me of something you talked about, Christy, provoked a question for me. Ben, what is a threesome?
That provoked that question for you, huh?
So, wow.
I think Christy, wow. I mean, it sounds like Christy knows.
Wow.
So, no, I...
some stupid sixth grader said it, you know, in school, which then causes my kid to be like, what's that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I find that so I've got a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old. My 12-year-old is a girl, and she's very, very sort of skittish about talking about sex in her body. Mm-hmm. My kids, I think I may have made a mistake as a parent. My kids have body safety talks every year of their grade school and the public school.
Okay.
And like the first 4 years or so through fourth grade, the body safety talk person, it's essentially awareness about your body, what biology is, what genitals are, and then like very much about like, you know, they talk about the no-no square where people can't touch you and mm-hmm. things like that. So it's actually done some pretty good work. But my daughter, when she was in first grade, she came home and she did not want to talk about this. But they gave a body safety talk to first graders with anatomically correct puppets.
Come on.
And I
for
said,
for real?
For real. Yeah. I said, well, this is, yeah. I said, Cece, how did it go? She said, it was chaos. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, they brought out these dolls with, what did she say? And you could see everything. And she said, and I said, well, why was it chaos? And she said, because all the boys were laughing and all the girls were screaming. And I thought, that is perfect, right? That's like the perfect. But then I, you know, because that was like a place of like weirdness for her, whatever, I started to make jokes about it. And I would do like a really obnoxious voice and say things like, welcome to my body safety talk. My name is Hank, and we're going to talk about body safety. Just to like make a joke about it, right? But yeah. I think that it's done some unhelpful work too. Mm-hmm. Even though I'll tell you, it's a pretty good bit, and it should get more laughs than it gets. But yeah, so I'm looking for ways into having these conversations with my kids. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. Here's my tip. Here's my one tip that you can take. This week, this is, I don't know. I asked my kids this. I recently asked my kids, like, what part of their body do they really like? Just to be aware and to be able to verbalize that. But then I also asked my kids in the car when we're driving and they don't have to look me in the eye. I asked them, like, what sexual question have you heard a student ask another student? So that it's not like them. Right? Like, what question do you have?
Yeah,
but it's
good.
Like, so that they're then, I'm kind of getting a gauge as to like, where are their friend, what's their friend group talking about? What kind of questions are coming up? And what kind of questions may they have that they're scared to ask? Because if they just say like, a friend asked another friend, you know, what's a threesome or whatever, then it doesn't feel so scary, personal or whatever.
That's
anyway.
That's really interesting, Christy.
I
like
You're
it. Full of practical tips.
I'm trying. Like
Yeah. No, it's good. I mean, this is sort of your wheelhouse too, in the sense, Christy, that you are a pastor of families and kids.
Right.
And this stuff is kind of always on your radar. Mm-hmm. As we were talking to Sam, when we're talking about embodiment, I was reminded of the last night I was like looking in the mirror and, you know, I'm no spring chicken.
I do know that.
You know that?
Yeah.
And I was looking in the
Closer
mirror.
Closer to 50 than 40.
Yes. And I was, Sharon was sitting in bed reading. I said, Sharon, all I see when I look into the mirror is that I'm fat and ugly and tired and old and wrinkly. And so I really need a compliment. I really need you to give me some compliment. And she said, okay, well, then your eyesight is darn near perfect.
That's a good one, Matt. Oh my goodness. Well, in this case, I'm really
almost slightly on topic too.
I know, right?
Well done. almost slightly.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, good conversation.
Well done, everybody.
Good to be together.
Yep.
Okay.
We'll see you all next week.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.